You're listening to the Blue Box Podcast, and for the next 60 minutes, we'll be talking about Doctor Who, so you don't have to. Hi, I'm JR.
And I'm Simon.
I'm going to start with an email. This came from Sean M. Vale. He said, I don't quite know what to say about the season so far. I love the characterisations of both Bill and the Doctor, but the stories so far have left me really flat. They feel like stories we've already seen on Doctor Who, and not that long ago. They have had great production values and really amazing acting, but the stories themselves have left me unimpressed in the end. I love Bill and her relationship with the Doctor, but all of the stories so far have been pat in the end. It seems to me the actors have been doing their best, but the scripts and the editing have let them down. And that's from Sean M. Vale. And I think I know where he's coming from. Although I don't think he necessarily phrased quite what he was feeling. I think he was reaching for what he was feeling and couldn't find a way to say it.
Compared to what we're used to, there's a lack of body to it. But that doesn't mean it's empty. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when Russell T. Davis was doing Doctor Who, you knew what you were getting every year. The first series laid it out. You had fluffy episodes for the first third or maybe two-fifths of the series. And then it gradually started getting a bit more serious. And then the latter half of the series, you'd have things like The Empty Child or Human Nature. And you'd have and Utopia and things like that, Midnight. And the meaty stuff was always at the end of the series. And then Stephen Moffat came along and you'd have things like Time of Angels. And you'd have things like kicking season six off with The Impossible Planet. And you'd have episodes that were unbound by format and just
time hopping and.
Yeah, but you had episodes where you just sat there and looked at the television and thought, what on earth was that? Because it wasn't what you were expecting. You know, under Stephen Moffat, we've kind of got used to the idea that Doctor Who's not going to be what you're expecting. And this year, he's gone back. Oh, he's not gone back strictly to the Russell T. Davis formula. And he's certainly not gone back strictly to the way Russell T. Davis did it. But he has gone back to a formula. And he has gone back to doing it in a way that, you know,
populist is the wrong word, isn't it?
No, yeah, it's not that. It's kind of, I don't think it's really that different. But what it is it's taken out. It's not exactly taken out the imagination, because there's obviously still imagination at play. But it's not the bowl you over imagination that you'd get with something like Listen or The Magician's Apprentice. The Sorcerer's, whatever it was, that started off last time, where it just kind of, we just sat there and stared at the television
screen. It's quite linear now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been very. The first one, the pilot, was threw a bunch of curveballs in there, but in such a way that you didn't notice the curveballs and you were concentrating on other things. And then Smile did this beautiful thing where you were just looking at it and it was like this beautiful painting, but it didn't have any depth.
No.
And then Thin Ice was so good at what it was doing that it kind of distracted you from the notion that what it was doing wasn't especially innovative. So, I mean, I think Thin Ice is an absolutely fantastic Doctor Who story, but if that's the best of what we've had so far, that's kind of saying, well, where are the ones that are going to make you sit up and say, oh, my God? And we've not had, well, up to episode 4, we've not had anything that's made you sit up and say, oh my God. Well, we're about to discover where we think, whether we think episode 5 did.
It's like a band who have started off doing fairly simple pop songs, and then they've suddenly gone into their beardy, weirdy Beatles era of doing lots of experimental stuff. And then they think, we're just going to do a pop album now. 2 Minute Wonders.
And they do a pop album, and everybody says, well, it's really nice that they're doing... Well, the people who like the pop ones probably think this is the best album for years.
Yeah.
But the people who got into the experimental phase are probably thinking, well, it's very nice that they're doing another pop album, but after the experimental phase, it's a bit bread and butter and it's not as fulfilling.
Yeah.
So it's kind of...
But actually, through that experience, it's more refined in some respects.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely it is. And that's why you get something like The Pilot, which feels like a pop song, but it's got so many layers to it that actually you pick away at it and it's not really just a pop song.
No.
But if you're used to, I don't know, the extravagance that we've had for the last 5 years, and if you had a taste for that extravagance, you kind of miss that extravagance. Have you been missing the extravagance?
No, because I found it quite refreshing.
Really?
I
find it refreshing but unfulfilling.
Yeah, no,
I know I gave
I can
a 10
see that.
To Thin Ice, and I thought Knock Knock was very good also, and I loved The Pilot, but they're like constituent parts.
Yeah.
Each one in its way is fulfilling in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, I haven't told you my score for Knock Knock, have I? But anyway, yeah, I'll do that later.
Okay, yeah, they haven't added to me. That each one's been fulfilling in and of itself, but they haven't added up to anything yet. And I suppose we'll get to Oxygen in a minute and find out whether... But, okay then, go on, tell me then about Knock Knock. What was your score for Knock Knock?
Knock Knock. See, it was tricky because I thought it was marginally better than Smile. But I don't want to give it... I can't remember. Did I give Smile a 7? I think I did, didn't I? A generous 7.
Yeah.
But I want to give Knock Knock a 7, which brings Smile down. But I think I will, but it is marginally better than Smile, I thought.
Well, that's
But funny you say that, I did feel Knock Knock was slightly empty. It was quite nice, and it was filmed well, and it was, I'd say, acted well. David Suchet was amazing. The supporting cast were pretty poor.
Did you think so? I thought the students were really good.
I'm probably thinking of one particular cast member, probably. There was that one chap with the very expressive eyes.
Harry Sullivan's grandson.
Yeah.
I thought he was really good.
Did you? Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, maybe it was a character portrayal. I don't know.
Well, maybe. I thought he seemed a bit odd at the start, but then I thought when he was alone with the doctor, he really came into himself.
I like the idea of it. I thought it was pretty monstrous and worked really well as a kind of threat. And then when the actual threat showed itself, those little bugs, it all felt a bit, I don't know what the word is really.
Jarring?
Funny you use the word unfulfilling. I thought it was an unfulfilling enemy as such. And when it started bringing everyone back and putting them back together again, I thought, that's when I thought we've seen this before. That seemed like a little magic button to bring everyone back to life.
You see, I was going to save this for later, but I've got a couple of things to address about Knock Knock. But I thought some of the shifts in tone were jarring, but actually I thought the writer, Mike Bartlett, did a really good job of making everything make sense.
Yeah. Oh, no, it added
and
up.
And actually, one of the things that people didn't think make sense was the fairy tale aspect.
Okay.
As in, how does... David Suchet's character afford to live for 70 years, but he doesn't appear to have a job and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I thought, yeah, okay, that's a plot hole if you want this to be real life. But patently, when you get to the end of that story, it's meant to be a fairy tale, right? So those questions are questions with little relevance. And if you want to ask the question, well, where does he get his money from? Well, then... he's got a paper round or something, or he inherited money.
He's inherited a big house, for God's sake.
So, I mean, that's only a question if you want it to be a question, right? And
well, you've got to think about it too much, which obviously, without being rude, some people obviously are, is that these things seem to be able to create something out of nothing anyway, don't they? So,
well, yeah, people, yeah, okay, some people think about it too much, but they don't, but in doing so, don't think about it quite enough, because what they're doing is they're looking for the holes, but they're not prepared to add two and two together and say, well, okay, from somewhere.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? They don't. They're looking for the, well, if you're doing that, you're looking for it not to add up.
Well, you can go back around for the series and find stuff like that.
Right in every story.
But I thought it was, as I say, I think the style of it, I think the tone of it was fantastic from the start. I like the knock-knock aspect of it. That was quite nice. And I quite liked the little twist of it being his mother rather than his daughter.
Yeah.
I thought that was a nice little flipping of the dynamic, but it was unfulfilling.
All right. Well, two things that I've heard over and over in people's reviews and on social media and in podcasts for the last week since Knock Knock. Two things over and over, more than anything else, that have been asked. One, how come the six kids, or the five, because Bill wasn't absorbed during the course of that episode, were still alive at the end of it, and none of the previous ones?
Yeah, that was explained.
Yeah, that was perfectly obvious. The house
I've only
takes
watched it once
20 time, but... years to absorb six people.
There was actually a line saying that they've only just been absorbed, so...
So they haven't been digested yet?
No.
No, that was really obvious.
Mm.
And the other one seemed to me really obvious as well. All these people were saying, well, if the lice, the dryads, are controlled by sound, why doesn't the doctor use the sonic screwdriver to control them? And they weren't controlled by sound. They were awoken by sound.
Yeah.
And then they did their own thing that they were, for want of a better word, programmed to do.
Mm.
But he didn't use a tuning fork and then use the tuning fork at different pitches to tell them what to do.
Kind of
he just woke them up.
Yeah. And along the same lines, there was that little, like you say, fairy tale moment where the daughter stroke mother controlled them, which I thought was a little bit of a wave of magic wand. It was like, you had to suspend your disbelief about that.
But the whole story was that when they initially, 70 years previously, woke up, they like, I can't think of what the phrase is, but if you, not placebo, but something like that, something that has no programming will take the first programming it's given, and then we'll keep that programming. So when these are first introduced to her, that's when they first have contact with people. So they imprint upon her, and she becomes their god, for want of a better word. So they do what she wants, essentially.
Okay.
But she's not aware that they're doing what she wants. So the whole point of the story is that they're keeping her alive and they're doing her son's bidding, her father's bidding.
They become her life support system.
So it's exactly the same as the nanogenes turning everybody into face mask monsters in The Empty Child. And if you've seen The Empty Child, you shouldn't need this bit of this episode explaining to you, because that's how it works. And it's only at the end, when she says, no, this is wrong, that, well, essentially they kill themselves. But that was another question. Where have they gone at the end of the episode? They've basically sort of committed suicide. Or they've been around for 70 years, and let's face it, that's probably way more than of a natural lifespan than whatever. Either way, at the end of the story, she dies, they die along with her, and people have said, well, why did the house collapse? Did they tear it down? No, they didn't tear it down, but they were what was holding it up by this point. So when they went, it just fell in on itself. And other people have said, well, what happened to the students' clothes then? Well, I guess when the house fell in on itself, they could probably just dig through the rubble and get them back. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All these questions are questions where you can find an answer if you just sit there and think about it for 2 seconds without having your, oh, but it doesn't make sense head on. Was there anything else before we talk about oxygen?
I don't Don't think so.
I've got a few other things to bring up later, but therefore the what is rapidly becoming the 5-minute spoiler section at the end, or speculation section, whatever.
Mm.
Okay, then, Oxygen. Was this the week where it kicked into gear? Was it more fulfilling this week?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I really, really loved it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Yeah. I caught myself doing, I'm trying to find fault. And I don't think I did. I don't want to immediately go for the things that I thought were slightly lacking, but I don't think it matters really. I just think it was tonally and the pace of it and the feel of it, and even the soundtrack was lovely, and the performances. I don't think there was a weak performance in it.
There was some references to sort of alien sci-fi music, yeah. And then some references to 50s sci-fi music on top of the usual Murray Gell. Mm. That was nice to hear. It was the a direction, real mixture.
The camera work was gorgeous. I mean, I feel like I'm going to enthuse and say everything I want to say in the first 5 minutes, but I really did think it was held together, and I've not been so gripped and probably as creeped out by an episode in a very long time. Oh, right. I wouldn't show it to my children.
Oh, no.
No.
That was, yeah, there were some bits in there that were...
I didn't like it when they're in a room with a dead body. I didn't like it at all.
And when the... when you actually saw the people dying and...
Yeah.
And actually, when you realise that the people inside, that it was... Because it looked like zombies, right?
Yeah.
So it looked like there were people walking around.
Yeah.
But when you realised it was the suits that were walking around and they just happened to still have a body left inside them...
Yeah.
That was a really creepy moment.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I'm sure some people relate that to Silence in the Library, but it wasn't the same.
It fairly was, but...
Visually, yeah, but it wasn't the suits walking around last time, was it?
No. Okay, right. I think there are certain areas where this, given the whole conversation about the series so far being unfulfilling, I think there were 3 or 4 areas in which this... I did this last week with Knock Knock. I don't know if you've listened to it. I said, right, okay, this is great, but these are the areas in which it's kind of questionable.
Mm.
And I think the kind of questionability of it is a sort of a value that you put on whether those things matter.
Mm.
So I'll tell you what my issues were, insofar as they're issues at all. One, well, this one's kind of an issue. I think Bill was a bit badly served this week.
Okay.
You got 4 episodes in which, in previous series, and particularly in the Russell T. Davis ones, but, I mean, Stephen Moffat did this too. He had that scene with Amy in The Beast Below where she had to figure out what was going on. We've had the scenes with Bill where she's got to figure out what's going on. And there was even a scene this week where she figured out something amongst what was going on. So she's doing all the figuring out things. But also, the companions got to prove that they want to do it and that they're up to doing it.
Mm.
And I really didn't like the moment in Smile 3 weeks ago where they go back to the TARDIS and she says, can we just shut the door and get out of it?
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, fair enough. That's probably realistic for just a regular human being.
Mm.
But if somebody's going to be the Doctor's companion and he's going to choose to take them along on adventures, then he's not going to choose somebody who's the kind of person who, when they get back to the TARDIS with everything left unresolved, says, can we shut the doors and get the hell out of here? And I thought it was slightly unrealistic to have her say that and for him to then carry on afterwards without questioning the fact that she said that.
Mm.
And then she did it again this week. And I'm thinking, this is 5 adventures in now. She's seen all these things 5 times now.
Yeah.
And here she is still saying, can we just get in the TARDIS and go home?
I thought it worked. I thought it, with the tone of the story and the fact that they were in a situation where they literally could have run out of oxygen.
But but it started before they even knew that.
Mm.
Kind of her reluctance to play the part of the companion started right from the moment they arrived almost.
Mm.
It seemed to me. And for about the first half an hour of the episode, I was thinking, when is her companion is, when is her companionism going to kick in?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, ain't gonna.
Well, maybe that's the, if there is a flaw, maybe that's it. It did start too early. But I think once they got into that situation, wanting to get out of there wasn't a bad thing. I think I didn't detect that.
Oh,
and the only thing moment, I did think, well, she at least, you know, she stopped asking questions now because she's trying to save oxygen. So
the moment when the doctor says there are 40 suits and we've got 36 without life signs, and he waits for her to answer, and she basically just says, let's get out of here. And then he has to tell her there are 4 suits that still do have life signs, and that's what we're here for. We've got to do something about it. That was the moment when she should have said, when he said there are 36 suits without life signs, she should have said, and there are 4 with, and we've got to stay and do something about that, haven't we, Doctor? Because that's what we do. That was the moment when she should have stepped up. And even if then, afterwards, she still reverted to being scared because the situation was out of their control,
yeah,
should at least have had a moment earlier in the episode where she said, no, this is what we do. We've got to step up. And she didn't. And I thought that was a bad mistake that undermined her character.
See what you're saying? So she spent the episode essentially being a victim.
Yeah, essentially. And that's not something we've been used to in Doctor Who. And especially not in the last few years because, you know, whatever you say about Clara.
She was passive, wasn't she? There wasn't.
Yeah, she never... I don't... There was one moment where they gave her something to work out, right? But that almost felt afterwards as if she'd been given that to work out because, god damn it, she wasn't doing anything else.
She essentially took a backseat to Nardole this week.
Yeah, kind of. And I was really looking forward to seeing Nardole this week. And he had some great moments. But also he had some slightly irritating moments. Did you think?
I've started thinking exactly how long has he been travelling with the Doctor. It must be an awful long time because his bitterness isn't just, you know, that he's lost his body.
Not traveling with, but living with.
Yeah. He's become very, don't know what the word is really. Not nonchalant, that's not the right word, but he's become very matter of fact about a lot of it and sort of, you know, he's very experienced with it all and seems to know it all.
And he dropped a few hints this week about the nature of his reanimation that might lead to something later on, further on down the line. Well, he said something about... There was that bit where he was pinching his skin. And there was almost... I can't remember what the line of dialogue was, but there was some kind of suggestion about maybe he wasn't even actually Nardole at all. Did you not? Yeah, I don't know. It was just... I thought there was a hint that he was someone else entirely. He was just there to look like Nardole. He said something about, this isn't my face, this is somebody else's face. I can't remember exactly.
There was an odd line like that. Yeah. I have to watch it again.
I don't know whether that... maybe that's just another foreshadowing, the fact that the Doctor's going to regenerate later in the year moment, but... I tell you what, I hope to God the Doctor gets his eyesight back at some point during next week's episode, because I can see the dramatic purpose of having him blind at the start of an adventure, but if that's going to carry on for several weeks, or maybe even the entire rest of the season, you're going to be very irritated.
A prediction, in as much as I think that the injury that's going to bring on his regeneration is going to be much earlier in the series, which I'm sure some people have thought anyway. Hence, we've seen that little clip of his hand going, and that will be what brings back his sight.
It could be, yeah.
So he then spends the remaining episodes essentially having a very long, you know, terminal condition.
And again, that could be very irritating in and of itself. Do you know if it's like...
It doesn't have to be, but yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, it becomes a thing. And you know what? That's him being blind or him being stuck in mid-regeneration.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing I think drags a story down rather than bolsters it up. Because although it's cause for drama, it's cause for an external drama. It's not part of... It becomes something that's external to the plots.
Right.
That has an effect on the plots, that bends the plots out of shape. So if the Doctor's blind, that's got nothing to do with next week's story. But his blindness is probably going to bend that story out of shape a bit. And if he's staving off a regeneration, that's probably, you know, say that happens in episode 8 or something, and then he spends 5 episodes, including Christmas, fighting off this regeneration. Well, if it happens in episode 8, that's not going to have anything to do with the plot of episode 9, but it's going to have an effect on the plot of episode 9 that'll throw the plot of episode 9 slightly out of balance. And while that might make good tension, to me, that's tension that's not been earned by the story, but tension that's been introduced into the story from somewhere else.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm just...
It depends how they... yeah, I think it could work. I think it could work, but I don't think it should go on any longer than it needs to, I think, like you say.
I just hope that at some point during next week's episode, he finds some way to... Even if it's just doing... we see him with the dark
glasses. We may get a moment where he suddenly turns around and say, I can see again, but I didn't tell you, or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think we will. What we might get is a moment where he says, right, I've fixed up the dark glasses now so that I can effectively see, even if I can't actually. And then we more or less forget about it.
Yeah.
Unless it becomes a, you know, needs to be addressed somewhere. I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Because...
It's nice use of the sunglasses, though.
You know, on the one hand, though, it's a good thing in that what you're effectively saying is, here is a disabled character who can be the lead in the series, who can be an action hero in spite of the fact that he's blind, Daredevil. But on the other hand, you know, addressing those things is great, but at the same time, doing it in something like Daredevil, where essentially you're in the same place every week, and essentially you have a regular cast that goes through every week, and essentially the stories are coming to the character. That's one thing. But in Doctor Who, every week you're somewhere new. Every week you've got a new cast of characters, and every week your character goes to them. And I think it becomes more difficult to sustain. So so what I'm saying is, I don't think it's a wrong thing to do. But I'm saying I don't think it quite fits the format of the series.
Something's just tweaked in my brain. There isn't a Greek... Is there a Greek legend or something like that where the hero is blind but his enemies don't know that?
Oh, it could be, yeah.
I'm trying to think. Or maybe it's just a previous... It's a different show.
I think Stephen Moffat's done the Greeks before.
Yeah.
And it would be very like him.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds
I like the idea. I like the idea, but it, as you say, it does really depend on how they serve it and how, as you say, how it, whether it shapes, whether it's straight, yeah, whether it shapes the story or whether it,
Yeah, it's one of those things, I don't know, it's just, I tell you what, it's just a personal thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, if your hero gets an injury.
Yeah.
I don't want that injury to be carrying on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Do you know what? It's funny because I started reading some of the BBC books, you know, the Paul McGann ones.
Yeah.
That went, and there's a point in those stories where the Doctor loses one of his hearts.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I started reading one of the stories, and the first part of this, I can't remember, is it something like Camera Obscura or something like that? I only got so far through it, but there was a big section about how the Doctor was pondering and listening to his single heart and all that. And I thought, is that going to happen in every book that involves that? Somebody shouting at the...
Yeah, at the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, who knows? But yeah, I thought the same thing, actually. I thought, well, how exactly does that, apart from the Doctor ponders the fact he's got one heart now? I don't exactly know how that affects things.
Yeah, and how is it going to affect the next several stories if he's got no eyesight? Because that is going to affect things. And, okay, there's a story to be told. And actually, the next three episodes are all set on Earth. So what I've just said about the Doctor goes to the stories, maybe, in a way, the stories are coming to him. So maybe that offsets it. But then, next week, we're in Rome. So, you know, it's you might not be going off-world or into the past, but... It's not like he's just sitting in his study at the university solving crimes. Do you know what I mean? It's a funny thing. It's just a personal thing. It's like I just said, it's like if your hero gets an injury, I don't want that injury to be carried on through the next X amount of stories.
Is it going to be a surprise episode where some weeping angels turn up? That's what I want to know.
You've been watching too much Class.
Yeah.
There was another thing as well in here, and that was, and this relates back over the last few weeks as well, and it was, it's another technology gone wrong, inverted commas, story.
Mm.
So way back in 1967-8, you had season 5, where every week, apart from The Enemy of the World, it was a base under siege. And looking back at it now, people think a lot of those individual stories are classics, but watching it at the time, it might have got a bit of a drag, watching the same story every week. And I suppose there have been other times when Doctor Who's done that. Season 7, every week, we're in a new installation of some kind. Seasons 8 and 9, every week, it's aliens trying to invade Earth. Seasons 13 and 14, every week, it's another Hammer horror. And at the moment, it's every week, it's a technology that's somehow doing it rather than a villain. Mm. Or at least that's what people have been saying about this series. But you look at episode 2, and that's a technology gone wrong, but, and it's, this is kind of sold to you by the pound sign bit at the end.
Mm.
It's kind of a commentary on, not conservatism, capitalism.
Capitalism, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually said it this week.
Smile, yes, that's it. Smile was kind of a commentary on capitalism.
Mm.
And Thin Ice was certainly a commentary on capitalism.
Mm.
And when people said, well, the monster turned out to be benign, kind of missing the point, because the monster wasn't a fish, the monster was Sutcliffe.
Mm.
And he certainly didn't turn out to be benign, but that was a commentary on capitalism. Mm. Last week, Knock Knock, it's a commentary on capitalism again. It's a man who's selling something he technically does have, but that he doesn't have to sell to people in order to trick them out of their money plus lives plus life essence. It's about somebody in a position of power people in a position of no power in order to get something off them.
Well, yeah, and putting the needs of the few against the needs of the many.
And this week, again, it's...
parasitic.
And this week, again, a commentary on capitalism. And this week, there was a monster. And this week, the monster was the corporation.
The suits.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that was the... that was the...
Well, yeah, that was wordplay, but it...
But, yeah. But this is, it was about the company this week, and the company was the monster. And we might not have actually got to see the headquarters at the end when he dropped them off, but that was definitely the message this week.
Mm.
So this theme of technology misunderstanding or misinterpreting isn't quite right, because there was no misunderstanding or misinterpreting this week.
No, that was kind of the twist, though. You just assumed the suits were malfunctioning and doing pretty much the same as what was happening in Smile, but it wasn't. It was they were doing exactly what they were supposed to do.
They were doing what they were programmed to do
by
the company, and that was kind of the point. Mm. So there was a monster this week.
So it was a murder mystery in some respects. Yeah,
in effect. Do you think it stacked up?
Yeah, I do.
There was one moment where I thought, I agree. I think it did. I think there were a few leaps to be made.
There was,
but fewer than in Smile.
The whole thing of Bill not dying was a real leap of, that was lucky.
I thought that at the time.
It has a logic. Don't get me wrong. It has a logic, but equally it's like, oh, well, just as well it was her suit that did that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just as well it was her suit that had the battery low.
Yeah.
But then if it hadn't been her suit that had the battery low, she wouldn't have been the one who got left behind.
Mm.
So, in the end, it was completely logical. Yeah, my initial thought was, well, that's a bit of a leap.
Yeah.
And also, I thought, at the time when I was watching it, I thought, well, there's a bit of information that the audience didn't have, and only the Doctor did. So when he says, well, actually, her battery was low, so I knew she wasn't going to die, that's a bit of a cheat on the audience. But when you think about it, no, because we've seen over the previous 20 minutes that she's been having all these problems with this suit. So that at the moment where you think she's going to die, if you're not thinking about other things, and you were and the episode was distracting you, if you weren't thinking about other things, you'd think, how is she going to get out of this? And if you concentrated hard enough and thought about it hard enough, you'd say, well, the way she's going to get out of this is because her suit can't do anything else. So it's certainly not going to be able to kill her.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the end, I thought that was fine.
Mm.
But there were, in Smile, it was like the Doctor was jumping to every conclusion available and getting them all correct. And the reason we knew he was getting them all correct was because we had that pre-title sequence where we got to see what was going on. So we were way ahead of him.
Yeah, I think one thing Lee said to me about that was, and I don't know if he said it in the podcast, but he thought the episode would have been better without that.
That's because I said it to him in the episode.
Oh, you said
it. Yeah. But this week, you didn't have that.
Yeah.
So this week, it worked, and we were all finding things out together.
Yeah.
So you were trying to leap ahead of the Doctor to figure it out, and you couldn't. And I thought that his resolution, fixing them up to the, I can't remember how they phrase it, basically fixing them up to the nuclear reactor. Mm. So if they die, the whole profit goes up in smoke, everything.
Yeah.
I thought that was a brilliant solution.
Absolutely,
to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought the way he got there just shaded on the Smile thing of him leaping to a conclusion. Not that wasn't necessarily there to be leaped to, but that I didn't think he had enough information necessarily to be certain enough.
I don't know, because I thought, oh, I see what you're saying. In as much as he had to reach that conclusion that actually these things were, this thing was happening because
due to something that somebody had said.
Yeah.
Rather than due to something that somebody had said about profit being the motive for everything, right?
Yeah, I suppose that was, and that was a little trail that was threaded right through the episode.
Oh, it was. But what I mean is, he's taking that from one of the human beings who's in a stress situation and isn't necessarily going to speak directly.
Mm.
Or
you could argue he's making a gamble, though, that he thought, well, sod it, we're going to die anyway, so let's do this and see if it has an effect. So,
well, he even says earlier in the episode, we're going to die anyway if we don't put these suits on, so let's put them on. And
yeah.
And I'm pretty sure they're going to be okay, but we'll find out when we do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's taking that gamble.
Mm.
But the way it's played at the end, because this is, I suppose, a directorial choice and an acting choice. And I don't think quite the director and the actors gave you the impression that the Doctor was taking a gamble at the end. When he said, I've worked it out, or not literally said, I've worked it out, but when he got to the point where he turns around to everybody and says, I've worked it out, I felt he was saying it with more conviction than it merited. Because usually an actor will show you that even if they're speaking with conviction for the benefit of the other actors, there's some doubt in their mind for the benefit of the television audience at home. And I didn't think we had that doubt.
No. So, he was pretty forceful, was saying, yeah, I've lost the plot.
Yeah,
I'm
just
going to do this because I feel like it.
Yeah, so it kind of, I don't know, I wasn't quite sold on that. It might play better on a rewatch.
Yeah.
But I wasn't entirely, but I've been for about the last 20 minutes or so, I've been poking holes in it.
Yeah.
That aren't really there to be poked.
No, I don't think so.
No, but I did this with Knock Knock. I was like, these are the issues. Now it's a case of, are they actually issues? And it's one of those, yes, they can be,
because
Knock Knock certainly had issues.
Yeah.
If you wanted them to be issues, but if you sold yourself to the fairy tale at the end, I mean, this was a woman who's supposed to have been kept in a room for 70 years, right? Like Rapunzel or somebody.
Yeah.
So you either went with it and said, okay, if she's been in that room for 70 years, all bets are off as to everybody's mental state and everything.
Mm.
Or else you said, no, she's been kept in a room for 70 years. That's ridiculous.
She must have been bored.
Nobody. So it was either, yeah, okay, fair enough. Or it was, no, nobody would allow themselves to be kept in a single room for 70 years.
Mm.
That's just too ridiculous to accept. You either accepted it or you didn't. And this week, again, there were certain things where you either had to accept them or not. So all the things I've brought up just now are like, they're things you either accept or you don't. Patently, you did.
Mm.
I'm wavering.
Mm.
Mm. I think.
In comparison, I thought Knock Knock was quite flimsy.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I didn't think it was. I thought, like Thin Ice, it had a lot of weight.
Mm.
But I thought it disguised it well. Okay. But I thought it was that shift of tone at the end into fairy tale out of the sort of teens in peril horror aspect that I thought was wrong-footing enough that it unsettled.
Okay. Mm.
So, I don't know. That was my take on it.
Mm.
And I thought it got away with it. But I could see that for, you know, it wouldn't, not for everybody.
Mm.
Mm. Whereas this week, well, here's the dilemma. This week, I'm looking at this episode and thinking, on a second watch, that'll probably be something where I don't mind about all these things anymore. But we always review these episodes after a first watch.
Yep.
And there's a reason for that, because 90% of the people who watch Doctor Who never do have a second watch.
Mm.
So you have to take it on face value the first time. And although we know we're going to be talking about it afterwards, so we're looking at it slightly closer, and we're not in a room full of kids having their dinner or whatever, like a lot of people will, still you've got to take it at face value on the first. I think that's a more honest review, possibly.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm doing. And so my conclusion on this one is I'm slightly wavering.
Mm.
Because, and I think that scene with Bill, the bit where she doesn't say, yeah, no, you're right, there are four people, even if she'd just had that one moment, I think I would have accepted everything else. But I think her not having that one moment takes
that could actually be an editing thing, because we didn't really get to see a reaction to that, because she did start to react. No, but
we heard the Doctor have to tell her there are four people.
Yeah.
That was my issue, that the Doctor had to tell her that there were four people who were still alive.
Mm.
And, you know, that was in the script. The Doctor telling her that there are four people still alive. And that's my issue. And at that point, I am losing being sold on the drama.
I think if we hadn't had Smile before, then I'd say, well, she's still learning about the process, the fact that this is what the Doctor does, but we've seen it with Smile.
Oh, yeah. That's more so than with... Mm. In the other ones, there were things that sort of came to.
Yeah.
But in Smile, that was something that they went to.
Yeah.
This was the Doctor took it on as his job. Yeah, this was effectively...
This is what you do. But that we've been through that with Smile. Yeah, so I appreciate what you're saying.
So I think she needed to do that. And at that point, my disbelief was no longer suspended.
Yeah, see, I take the view that she was going through the journey that the audience was, because I was... not petrified, but I was quite freaked out by it. And I felt it was... that was the tone of the piece, and it was starting to get... quite early in the episode, we're starting to get, oh, this is all a bit nasty, this is quite claustrophobic, and I want them to get out of there. And she was feeling the same.
Unlike in Smile, I was gripped entirely throughout. Whereas, like I said, in Smile, after 20 minutes, I lost it.
Yeah.
And I just didn't care. For the last half an hour, I just didn't care, because it just wasn't selling it to me anymore.
Mm.
This week, it kept selling it to me, and I was gripped.
Mm.
Couldn't take my eyes off the screen. Absolutely worked on that level. But, you know, normally Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who, and when I say Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who, I don't mean necessarily just the ones he writes, but the ones that he's in charge of. Normally that works on so many different levels.
Mm.
And this week, I thought we got to that point, and I thought those other levels just peeled away at that point. And sometimes the statement it's making is a bit too obvious.
Mm.
So this whole thing about capitalism, it's like, yeah, we saw that last week and the week before and the week before that.
I don't care, because...
it's a good message.
It is an amazing message, and I think it's an incredibly timely message.
But yeah, oh yeah, no question. These episodes would have been written in the sort of full knowledge of what we as a country were looking to in our near-term future.
Mm.
I just thought it felt a little bit too spelled out.
Mm.
Because we'd already had three episodes in a row.
Yeah.
It's
getting to the point where it's punching the air, isn't it?
Yeah.
We've had somebody being punched out, and
There was a thing online, I never saw it, but I heard people talking about it, where... in Thin Ice, where the Doctor punches the capitalist for being not just a capitalist, but a racist. And
I think it's more a racist thing than...
It was more racist. Oh, it was more racist, the specific reason why he did it. But I think the capitalist thing was underlying the fact that the Doctor was in a place where he could do it.
Yeah.
So there was this thing online afterwards where they're doing the SJW. Does that mean anything to you?
SJW, it rings a bell.
Social Justice Warrior.
Oh, okay.
It's become the new PC.
Yeah.
So it's something that people who start their sentences with, I'm not a racist, but can beat people who are PC over the head with, you're a social justice warrior.
Yeah.
It's a term of denigration towards people who...
have a conscience.
Yeah. So, or... And so this became a thing after Thin Eyes. Oh, he's punched a capitalist racist on the nose. He's a social justice warrior. And people were up in arms about the fact that the Doctor was... you know, kind of basically a social justice warrior, when actually social justice warrior in terms of the television programme Doctor Who,
this is
a badge of honour.
Yeah, without going into that side of thing, this is this tone that's going on that that everyone should shut up now. Now that the right wing have a voice, and in that respect, the rest of us are supposed to shut up. Well...
No, now's the time for the voices to speak up louder.
Yeah, for everyone to speak up.
But in terms of Doctor Who,
yeah,
I just thought it was 1 week too many.
Yeah.
And if it...
And the fact that he actually used the word capitalist is... or capitalism, while I agree with the sentiment, you're absolutely right, it's like it's being forced home now, and it's...
Yeah, it's like, please don't do that again next week, because now that's...
Yeah.
...become too much of a thing.
Yeah, yeah. Even though I agree with it.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. And that's the point.
Yeah.
Agree with it completely. But you've got to... I've always said this. If you want to get a message across to people who don't like your message, you've got to smuggle it to them in a way where they're not going to recognise what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And having the Doctor standing there bellowing about capitalism ain't going to get that message across to people who don't agree with him already.
The thing I did like was the line right at the end where he said, and once you get that out of the way, you'll find another mistake, which I did.
Yeah.
I did like that.
Oh, yeah.
As depressing as it was, I just thought, well, it's not saying that capitalism is the evil. It's just the...
human nature.
An evil of our time. Yeah.
Human nature is that you'll always find a way to mess yourselves up.
Yeah, people will always be selfish.
I tell you what I really liked about that line.
Mm.
He said, and that was the end of capitalism. And that's like, and this is my thing, is like, and I'm sure it's not my thing, but what I mean is my philosophy is,
yeah,
we started out as cavemen, which is the ultimate in capitalism,
yeah,
absolute survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Then you develop into a capitalist society,
yeah,
where it's all about barons and landlords and what have you. Then you mutate again into a socialist society. And actually, for all the people moan about capitalism now, we are in a socialist society because, although there are people who
capitalists are trying to put a price on that socialist society.
Yes.
Yeah.
But essentially, especially in the United Kingdom, but not exclusively in the United Kingdom, we're in a socialist society because we do have a welfare state. And even if...
At the moment.
Well, the point is, once you create a welfare state, even if capitalism has a big lurch and makes it go away, well, it doesn't actually go away. They just put a price on it.
Yeah.
But then eventually, at some point, somebody else will remove that price. Once the welfare state exists, once as a species you've realised that it's a duty to look after the weaker members of society rather than survival of the fittest, that's there to stay as a philosophy, regardless of what pressures come to bear on it from the waft and wane of politics, right? So I think we're lurching to the right at the moment in the short term. And when I say in the short term, 10 years or something. But, you know, there's waft and wane. It comes
everyone's
and goes.
Pulling, yeah. They're pulling up their security blankets, essentially, yeah, aren't they?
And what happens after socialism is communism, where you don't just look after the weakest members of society, but where everybody in society is, in effect, equal. Obviously, you can never be at a point where everybody's entirely equal.
And then we're down to Animal Farm, aren't we, sir?
But his line in that episode where he says, and that was the end of capitalism, that to me is like, it's like he's ratifying the way I think about this, in that he's saying, and this is the point at which socialism turns into communism. Do you know what I'm saying?
The writers have been reading Paul Mason.
Yeah. Is that what it, yeah, I don't know, because...
Oh, yeah. No, it's very interesting. Post-capitalism, it's very interesting.
Mm. But this is what has to happen.
Mm.
This is the way our species is going, regardless of what politics does to us. Because in the end, politics has to bow to the species, no matter how much it might
Paul Mason's outlook at post-capitalism, that I think one of the ideas behind it is this this realisation that the people who have the most worth in society are the creatives, are the ones who create the new ideas, who create the things that we all need, and therefore they become the wealthiest in society, whereas at the moment we've essentially got a government made up of middlemen.
Because we've got capitalism rearing its head for, like I said, a lurch, can't think of a better word offhand, but and they're the ones who don't like the creatives because they're more about the status quo than moving forwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's,
but there's never this realisation that they actually need the creatives.
Mm. Well, this,
and it's only because the creatives don't turn around.
The people who don't want to move forward.
No, yeah.
And that's the point.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, things change and it might not happen quickly enough. You know, ideally, in an ideal world, you wouldn't have this. We'd just keep moving forwards all the time.
Yeah.
But in order to take two steps forward, you've got to take a step backwards.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're in the middle of a step backwards, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, it sounds really pat to say it, but in some ways we've just got to take this step backwards on the chin and just put our efforts into making sure the next step we take is a forwards one.
Yeah, there's a lot of waking up going on as to whether that's going to come to fruition within the next few weeks. I don't think so, but...
Yeah, no.
But, yeah, anyway.
What did you think of, before we score it, well, obviously, it looked beautiful, right?
Mm.
What did you think of the performances?
I didn't have a... Do you know what?
The guest cast were really good.
I kept thinking of, and it's not just the kind of the situation, but I kept thinking of 42, thinking, God, this is how 42 should have been.
Really worked in some ways, but some of the acting wasn't of the best.
No.
And there were little moments in that where it felt cartoony.
Yeah.
Whereas this didn't feel remotely cartoony, and the acting, the guest cast in this.
I tell you what, there was one misstep. Sorry, is the husband. You had that lovely moment at the start where she said, "I want to have a baby with you."
Oh yeah.
He gave off nothing to suggest he just lost his wife.
I didn't take it necessarily that she was his wife. Was she? Did she say that?
Oh well, maybe not. Maybe I misread that. Maybe the fact that he couldn't hear any of that.
Oh, no.
It was a crush and he wasn't
aware. I thought she was telling him she fancied him. She was saying to him, we're this close to death, I'm going to say...
I misread that. Yeah, okay.
I thought she was saying, we're so close to dying, I'm going to tell you my biggest fantasy in the hope that gets me through and remake it. And then she was gone.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's...
I don't know. That's how I'd read
that. That's quite bittersweet. That's...
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
I thought that performance of that line... Well, I thought it was... a good performance of that line, but I thought that was a really difficult line to give an actress.
Yeah.
So I'm not entirely sure that was 100% convincing. Mm. But once we got in, the people we met once we got inside, I thought were all excellent. And I thought the best one died more or less first.
Mm.
But then actually the others took up the slack and became the best ones.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That all worked.
No, I don't think it was a weak performance in there. I really don't.
No, I did. There were a couple of moments where I thought Pearl Mackey was struggling with some of the things Bill had to do. Only slightly. Mm. There were a couple of moments where I just thought she was...
It's definitely her weakest performance, but like you say, maybe she was underserved in that respect, that she had to just look freaked.
She felt a bit hesitant.
She spent the whole thing freaked out by the whole thing, which is kind of understandable. Mm. I don't have a problem with it.
But then I thought there were some other scenes where she was exceptional again.
Mm, mm.
So, although, yeah, I think this was probably her weakest episode yet, I think she's still doing a really good job.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Do you want to give it a score then?
Yeah.
Right.
I think, and I may be completely wrong, I can be shot down, but I think it's going to become a classic. And I think it's a 9 out of 10.
Well, a classic would be a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, but you know, me and my 8 out of 10s, I don't, because I don't, I give
get
it a 9 out of 10.
Over because, your 8 out of 10, Simon.
Because I don't think it's quite perfect for some of the reasons you've given. But I don't think I've been gripped by an episode like that in such a long time and been carried through and wanted to get them out of there. And actually the blind thing, when that was played, and I think the whole way that scene was played where he came out and he said the doctor's paid a price and you came in, and that was really quite a jolt for me. And I don't think I've seen an episode do that. I think it was just beautiful. I want to give it a 10 out of 10, but...
Why not?
Yeah, go on then. I'll give it a 10 out of 10. Is that my third one this series? It's at least my second, because I think they gave the pilot 10 as well.
Oh, did you?
Mm.
I can't remember. Or maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
You didn't give Thin Ice 10 out of 10.
I didn't.
You give it 8.
I know, it's rubbish, isn't it, really? But right. but the thing was that with Thin Ice, like you say, the story was quite thin, and as well as it played out. But I don't think this...
I don't think it was, you see. I don't think the story on Thin Ice was thin, and I don't think the story on Knock Knock was thin,
That with the email at the start of the thing, though.
I thought they were deceptively thin.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were anything like as thin as... Because I didn't think the pilot was either. I thought the pilot... Everybody says, oh, this is a typical episode where there's not much story and it's all about the companion. And I thought, no, you're kind of missing the point there, because... When you do that, it's the story is the companion,
yeah,
and everything else is the icing, right?
Yeah.
But I thought the icing was so well integrated into the story about the companion that they became a part of one another.
Okay.
So I thought that was deceiving you into thinking there wasn't much story, when actually there really was.
Well, it's like a macaroni cheese, isn't it? It's deceptively simple, isn't it? It's one flavour all the way through, but it's a really full, lovely meal. Me and my analogies, but I thought Thin Ice was great, and the more I think about it, the better it becomes. But where did this I saw a comment on Twitter from David Kitchen, hello David, about he agreed that you, because I've not listened to the podcast, is there a thing about the beast when it's released is an analogy for the EU? For Britain leaving the EU.
Oh, I didn't see this. Is it?
I don't know.
Is that what he said?
Well, he said the BBP, so I assumed it was us.
Oh, I don't remember anything.
Unless he's taken the mic.
Or maybe Matt said that. Was he at that?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, Matt could have said that.
Yeah. I thought it was an interesting slant on it.
Yeah, but it doesn't fit in quite, with the message of the rest of the episode.
It doesn't at all.
No, so that's... That's coming to do it after the fact and seeing something that's not intended to be there.
Yeah.
Isn't that Matt to a T? So I've got to score this week's episode.
Go on then.
So I'm teetering between a 7 and an 8.
Really? God almighty. Okay.
Oh, you think that's low?
Yeah.
God, you see, Well, I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt and go with the 8.
Yeah.
But I thought that fatally undermined Bill. When the doctor had to tell her, no, the reason we stay, after 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's what had me hovering over the 9, you know. It was.
Yeah, so...
There was an inconsistency to it, certainly.
But I didn't think it was anything like as... See, when Smile fatally undermined itself, it then went and did it again 5 minutes later, and then 5 minutes after that, it did it a third time, and it just kept doing it over and over again. And it never picked up. And
see, yeah, where I was going to give that a 6 and then went to a 7, that was because I was kind of charmed by the packaging. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people were.
I know. The story itself was awful. You know, so many of the reviews and the podcasts and everything else afterwards said it was great up until the last 10 minutes. I was thinking, and then you were reading what they were saying and listening to what they were talking about. And actually, they were talking about issues that were in there from about the 20-minute mark. So actually, they were sort of forgiving of all these issues until the last 10 minutes didn't resolve any of the issues.
It's just, one thing I have liked about this series, and a lot of people have been complaining about the pacing. I think the pacing did kind of go awry in Smile. But I thought the pacing in this was lovely. Wherein it needed to take its time, it really did. particularly, in the beginning of it. It was just, it just feels like it's breathing.
Yeah, it's deceptively sort of, I've always said this about Stephen Moffat's episodes as opposed to RTD's episodes.
Mm.
In a Russell T. Davis episode, you're squashing something to fit into 45 minutes.
Mm.
Whereas in a Stephen Moffat episode, you're opening up something smaller to expand to fill the 45 minutes.
Mm.
So they're kind of smaller stories that are...
It's something you usually see more of in Sherlock.
Mm. Yes, and what happens in Sherlock is that they expand it with a lot of noise and fuss.
Mm.
And oftentimes in Doctor Who, The Impossible Astronaut is a great example. It's expanded out to 45 minutes through a lot of noise and bluster and fuss.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I think some of those episodes, deceptively so, because they quite often have long, talky scenes, but because the dialogue is snapping backwards and forwards, and then you go to something fast and furious, you're kind of deceived into thinking it's a lot faster than it is.
Mm.
And I think what's happened this year is that they've just dialed back the pace of the dialogue slightly, so that the pace of the dialogue isn't... So that the pace of the dialogue isn't obviously deceiving you into thinking that the episode's faster than it is, but the pace of the dialogue used to be, or had been, what kept things flowing at a particular speed. And if you just dial back the pace of the dialogue, I don't even think the actual dialogue itself is any different, really. I think it's just the pace at which they're delivering it. I think the writing's more or less, I mean, apart from topics and subjects and things, I think the writing's more or less almost exactly the same as it has been for the last 6 years.
Mm.
I think somebody at some point down the line has just said, slow down the delivery. Not even to a noticeable degree.
Yeah.
But just that tiny fraction. It's like playing a 24 frame per minute film at 25 frames per minute for television in reverse. It's just that. Because when you know, obviously, when you watch a... I don't know if it's still true, actually, given new televisions. But on the old televisions, no, it must be still true. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to watch old programmes. So you're watching films slightly faster than they were made, which is why films on television are 5 minutes shorter than they are at the pictures.
Mm.
Did you know that?
I've heard that before, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is like that in reverse. I wouldn't be surprised if these episodes were all 47 minutes long with scripts that were exactly the same length as the ones that were 43 minutes long.
Mm. Mm.
It just feels like it's come down a frame per second.
Mm.
And that's made a big difference. More to me than any of the other changes, which feel a bit more superficial.
Can I just say one thing where I think it does deserve the 10 out of 10 is little touches like that. The blackboard at the start.
Oh, that was lovely.
Incredible. I thought that was just... And that's the point where I thought, oh, this is something special, this episode. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not my sort of episode. Do you know what's really interesting? I'm loving seeing everyone excited about the new Alien movie, but it's something that's always left me cold.
Alien.
Yeah. I mean, it freaks me out anyway. I can't watch it because the whole parasitic thing really gets to me. So I've always steered away from the Alien movies because they literally freak me out.
Oh, really?
But I don't quite get the fascination with it. And that's not me saying it's wrong. It's just not my cup of tea. But actually, this sort of episode isn't my sort of thing usually, but I absolutely loved it. I was, as you say, gripped.
I love the first Alien movie, not so much any of the others. Even Prometheus, which I finally got around to watching a few months ago.
Oh, silly.
It was almost like they lost their nerve at the last minute and had to throw a load of Alien stuff in to try and make it make sense.
Yeah.
Or to try and make it make sense to an audience who are expecting an Alien movie.
Mm.
And it sounds like with Alien Covenant, all they're basically doing is remake an Alien, but
it sounds like Greatest Hits. Yeah.
So I don't.
So that's not me slating Alien in any shape or form. It's just not my.
I don't understand the point. But when I say I don't understand the point,
it's a bit like Predator. Well, if ironically, it's a bit like Predator, and I know it's got more to it. But actually, Predator's got more to it because there's actually like some background and there's some body to the creature. There's a.
Honestly, worse than Lee. There's backstory to the alien. It's just there's
the fact... yeah, the species. There's a life cycle. Yeah, I get that.
And the fact that the company's involved.
Yeah.
But that's only enough backstory to sustain a film.
Yeah.
Whereas...
from what I've seen it, which probably makes Alien 3, ironically, story-wise, the most interesting one.
Yeah. Alien 3 only suffers because they had production problems and all kinds of it. Yeah. Should we talk spoilers?
Go on then.
Insofar as there are any. Well, okay, this is the point at which anybody who doesn't want to know anything about anything that's coming must turn off their podcast, because this is going to be it for the rest of the episode now. Okay, so next week is when the vault opens.
Okay.
Did you know that?
I didn't know how early it was coming in the series, yeah.
Right.
Well, that's good that they're not elongating that.
Yeah, no, Stephen Moffat said it in Doctor Who magazine. Doctor Who magazine also said, and when the vault opens, you won't believe your eyes. And Doctor Who magazine have also been telling us for the past several months that Missy's in next week's episode. And there was a box-off in Doctor Who magazine that was presumably therefore written after the rest of all these other things that said, oh yeah, now the secret's escaped that John Sims is going to be in Doctor Who this year. And they put that box out in with the rest of the stuff about next week's episode. Now, if that isn't shining a bloody great light at the fact that it's John Sim in the vault, you won't believe your eyes. How can that possibly be?
Was that before the John Sim thing leaked, was it?
Well, presumably that was written before the John Sim thing came out.
Right.
Or presumably it was said, the interview was said, and all this kind of stuff. All this stuff would have been being put together over several weeks, and then the John Sim thing comes out.
I'd like it to be a massive red herring. There's something even different, like the new Doctor in there or something.
Yeah, after Pop Goes the Weasel at the end of last week's episode, when the Doctor says, and the house was eating kids.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the Doctor.
No,
right?
No.
It's not going to be anybody good. We know it's a person now.
Mm.
Absolutely certain it's a person now.
Now,
there's only two candidates, Missy and John Sim.
Yeah.
And if Doctor Who magazine is saying you won't believe your eyes, well, that to me points firmly and squarely towards a reveal of a character coming back that you'd never in a million years expect to see because he's been superseded by somebody else in the role, doesn't it? Mm. It doesn't say, and it'll be the master that you've had for the last 3 years. It'll say, and it'll be the master that you didn't think you'd ever see again. So...
I'm assuming we're going to see a master regeneration.
Possibly. We talked about this last week.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, about the fact... I think we did on last week's... I'm sure we did, yes. About the fact that Missy bringing on John Sim's regeneration.
Mm.
The future master killing the current master in order so that he can turn into the future master. Wouldn't that be an interesting story to tell in Doctor Who?
Wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll say. So that's... I think that was either Cole or Steve who was on last week who said that. I think it was Cole.
Mm.
So, yeah, that. See, my criteria when you look to speculate about what you're seeing is the bottom line is always has to be, how does this story play for a casual audience? And if the bottom line is, well, it would be confusing, or it wouldn't mean anything to them, then generally speaking, it's not what's happening. And all the ways the last few series have ended, you know, Series 8, Clara's boyfriend saves the universe but gives his life to do it. That's an obvious emotional beat that anybody can understand, regardless of the mechanics of getting him into a Cyberman suit.
Mm.
And then Series 9, it's Clara gets a TARDIS of her own and goes off to basically become another Doctor. That's an emotional beat that a casual audience can understand, regardless of the mechanics that get you there. And actually, I was talking to Miles Northcott, and he said, yes, you can understand those things, but what you can't predict is how you'll get there. And I'm like, you know, the mechanics of how you get there, the logistics of it. And my response to him was, you're not supposed to be able to predict the logistics and the mechanics and the plot. You just, you know, you look at what the end is going to be and ask, is that a plausible way to end it?
Mm.
And if it is a plausible way to end it, it's the writer who'll get you there. That's his job.
Mm. Mm.
So I'm looking at Johnson being in the vault, and I'm still looking at the amount of clues we're being given about Bill turning out to be Susan. And Ed Russell can say as many times as he likes, no, that's not what's happening. That is so happening. Or else Stephen Moffat is deliberately trolling the entire audience.
Well, I tell you what, there was a moment in today's episode where he said, don't worry, you're not going to die, where I thought, what, is she going to regenerate or something weird like that for a brief second, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Thought struck me too.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, I've been even going back and in the first episode, right?
Mm.
The bit where...
was a photograph for a start.
Well, that is so obvious, right?
Yeah.
That looks like a red herring. But then when there are the montage of her serving chips up in the university.
Yeah.
And what's the song that comes on the radio? Of all the songs, of all the student-type songs that could possibly come on the radio and be playing over that montage, do you remember what it was?
No.
It was Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Oh, yeah, of course it was.
That wasn't the most obvious choice. Because, you know, there are other songs that have superseded that one that students these days are listening to rather than Joy Division, right?
Mm, mm.
That was only an obvious choice if you're in your 40s or 50s. Or if the line is saying something.
Mm.
Well, when we had Susan in 1964, she left the doctor to be with another man.
Mm.
And that wasn't... The way they split up wasn't her choice.
They might have just picked it because it's a great record, but yeah.
Well, if if it turns out that Bill is Susan,
yeah.
And if Heather, the pilot girl, comes back at the end of the series,
yeah.
And Bill leaves the doctor to be with Heather,
mm.
Love will have torn her and her grandfather apart once again.
Mm. Mm.
That just, if the other, if they're throwing other clues out as well,
mm.
then you've got to look at that and say, it's not accidental. So either she is going to be Susan, or else he is deliberately putting things in. Because every year somebody says, there's a new female character, that's going to turn out to be the Rani, or it's going to turn out to be Susan, right? Every year somebody says that. So I wonder if maybe in his final year he's winding everybody up by throwing... Because normally people will say these things without there being any clues to suggest it.
Mm.
This year there are so many clues to suggest it that either it's happening or else he's just putting those clues into one.
It was last week's episode, she literally called him Grandad, didn't she? So.
Mm. Yeah, that was so obvious, like it was in the first episode. You know, the picture in the first episode.
Yeah, yeah. There's also a picture of a river, so...
Well, there have been other clues throughout. I don't know if you read what I said, but last week in Knock Knock, you get a father who turns out to be a son, right?
Mm.
That is a familial relationship that is not what it seems on the surface. Well, if Bill is Susan, is not a familial relationship, that's not what it appears to be on the surface, and that there's a moment of revelation when you find out what it really is, which would be her unveiling as Susan... That seems to be a clue to point to that. 1963, November the 23rd. We first meet Susan where and in what circumstance? In a school as a cuckoo because she's an alien from outer space who's been placed in a school as a cuckoo. Where do we first meet Bill at the start of the pilot? She's going to lectures in a university when she has no right to be there. She's a cuckoo in the lectures in the educational establishment, just as Susan was on November the 23rd. Just this explanation.
I mean, Stephen Moffat's really good at tying up these loose ends, even if they're kind of quite historic. So he would have to explain how she's got back from 21st to 22nd century Earth.
Time war breaks out. Somebody knows where she is. You know how the Doctor is always saying, I can always sense other Time Lords. Literally all it takes is one of the Time Lords went to Earth in 2164 or whatever it is, said, you're a time lady. You're not supposed to be here. You're not safe here. She says, well, I ain't going home. And he says, well, in that case, Chameleon Arch, and I'll leave you somewhere safe. Leaves her on Earth in, you know, 2017, which is after it's been mended, after the Time War's over. Safe place. Doctor's never going to find you because you've been Chameleon Arched. You're in Bristol. There's no way he's ever going to fetch up in Bristol. What do you know? Next thing that happens, he fetches up in Bristol, and there they are. And of course they'd find each other.
Mm.
That's all it takes. A couple of lines of dialogue.
I miss the Dr. Perot in there in the first place, and that's why he's teaching her.
Possibly. I mean, you get the sense that he doesn't know.
Yeah.
He'd have to not know, or he wouldn't have done that thing with the photographs with the mother in the first episode.
Yeah.
So I don't think he knows. I think somebody else just moves her and puts her there for safety. You know, all it took when you got Derek Jacobi turning out to be the master in Utopia. Two lines of dialogue. I escaped the Time War by going to a safe place and putting myself under the Chameleon Arch. That's all you need to say about Susan. She escaped the Time War by going to a safe place and undergoing the Chameleon Arch.
So she's wearing a watch.
Couldn't find it. Well, I guess we'll find out. I think we're going to call it an end to the episode because I've got a frog in my throat I can't get rid of. Unless there's anything else you want to bring up.
I don't think so.
And we're now moving into this three-episode thing. Missy's in it next week, obviously. She's at the end of the trailer there.
Mm.
I'm not sure whether she's in more than just next week's episode.
She's in the Cyberman episode, isn't she?
No, what I mean is of these three
parts
that add up to a three-part story.
Oh, okay. Well.
So I wonder if she's just in the first one, then the second one is kind of related but not, and then the third one again is kind of related but not.
Well, if there's that three-part episode, I'd say he must get his sight back in at least the second one, surely.
You'd hope so. I wonder if her part next week is going to not be to do with next week's plot, but setting something up for later.
Mm.
A bit like last year, where she was in The Magician's Apprentice and didn't really have anything to do with the plot, but set up the hybrid thing for later in the series. Except, of course, she didn't turn up later in the series. So, to some people's eyes, that was unresolved.
Mm.
So, I don't know. Maybe this year it's a case of, okay, we'll have her set something up and we'll make sure to get her back. Because this year we're going to do the thing that keeps people happy.
That's one thing I was going to ask you. Jamie Matheson, what is his previous episode?
On Doctor Who?
Yeah.
He did Mummy on the Orient Express, Flatline, and The Girl Who Died. The Viking one.
Right, okay.
Yeah, he's got good
He's pretty form. Pretty consistent.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, he's pretty consistent, but I think he's... for me, all three of those episodes have got flaws.
No, I agree. Particularly The Girl Who Died, but that's me.
I think oftentimes you'll get a writer who comes up with a really good story, but there's some kind of a flaw in it that is too obvious to ignore.
Mm.
And then other writers will do a really good job of disguising the flaws. And say, for example, last week, Knock Knock, I don't think he did a brilliant job of disguising the flaws. Whereas Jamie Matheson this week did a much better job of disguising the flaws. But I thought the flaws this week were more of a problem. So when I recognised them, for want of a better way of expressing it, they were more of an issue for me. So last week I was prepared to forgive. Although actually I've given both episodes an 8. So I guess what we're saying this week is the flaw dragged it down from a 9. Whereas last week the disguisal of the flaws brought it up from a 7. Perhaps. Anyway, yes, going to call it a night now because I'm struggling a bit. But I think we've covered everything we were going to.
Yeah, great episode. Really good.
So next week we'll be back to talk about Stephen Moffat's mid-series episode.
Oh, this will be interesting.
Yeah, it's, well.
It'll be interesting to see the pacing of it and the, see whether we're back to meaty Moffat or... What's the word? A bit of salad.
Yeah, I get the impression it's probably going to be me, especially as he's starting up a little 3-episode story arc, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I almost forgot. Matt sent us a text.
Okay.
A very short one, like you did the other week. So Matt says about oxygen, A well-paced and exciting episode, fixing much of what Sleep No More and 42, Oxygen's closest relations, got wrong. A realistic space adventure, just in time for the release of Alien Covenant. The suits were really creepy, and it was a lovely touch with the woman corpse at the end. The bit where he tells her thank you.
Yeah.
The final twist was well hidden and provides momentum into the next three episodes. 9 out of 10.
Hey, there we go.
So you're both on a 9. No, did you go for 10 in the end?
I went for 10, yeah. So we've done an 8, 9, 10. So.
Yeah. Oh. Right, until next week then. I was JR.
And I was Simon.
And we'll speak again soon.